be talking about next is better parenting. And I don't mean to say that people who have children who have trouble are bad parents. You know, sometimes people come away and they say, well, he said, it's just all my fault. No, I really think as a society we need to look at how we're raising children. I really think it's become a very aversive thing to be a child in the United States. Not as aversive, don't misunderstand me, as being in Haiti or North Korea or the Sudan or any place like that. But it has become sort of an aversive circumstance compared to what it was when I grew up. And anything we can do to help parents, educate them how to discipline and teach their children, we ought to be doing as a church. Another good resource that I tell people about that I like is Ted Tripp on Shepherding Your Child's Heart. Those are a couple of good books. Lou Priolo on The Heart of Anger. He's also written an upgrade of it for adolescents, for teenagers, dealing with teenagers. And then Ted Tripp on Shepherding Your Child's Heart. Okay. You know, we learn in medicine by learning cases. Helen, could you get me a couple of Kleenexes, please? I don't know why. You know, I must be allergic to Ohio or something like that. I get here and my nose starts running. And I really hate to stand here and wipe my nose with my hand in front of you. It sort of just looks grody, doesn't it? Yes. Anyway, physicians learn by cases. You know, you go for the first year and a half in medical school, and it's like drinking water out of a fire hose. You know, they hand you every semester four books of 2,000 pages, and you're supposed to read them all and digest them and learn it all, and it's sort of a blizzard of facts. And then education turns. In the second year, in the second semester, they send you out on the ward, and suddenly now you are learning not by reading a page in a book. You go talk to a patient, and it toilet paper, you say? No. Napkins. We learn by cases, and we attach the facts that we know to people. And so I'm going to talk to you about some cases. As I entered the exam room, I saw a 12-year-old boy. And when I went in, he was occupied playing a computer game. That, by the way, is my granddaughter. All these pictures are my grandchildren. You can guess who does my PowerPoints. That would be my wife. Yes. Got to aim in the right direction. There we go. As I enter the exam room, I see a 12-year-old boy. He's occupied playing a computer game sitting on the exam table, and he doesn't even acknowledge my presence when I come into the room. So have any of you experienced this yourselves? Yeah, of course you have. And I look at him for a minute and decide what my strategy is going to be here. You know, his mom is sitting over across the way, and I look at him and I say, young man, could you turn your game off so that I can talk to you and examine you? And he doesn't even acknowledge that I'm in here. You know, he's just still, man, he's working. Just looks like this, you know. And then his mother raises her voice and says, turn the game off. To which he replies. Anybody know what he says? Anybody want to guess? I have to finish the next level. Yes, you got to wait. I got to get through the door. Can you just wait till I get through the door, please? If I turn it off, I'll lose what I've done. So his mother tells him to turn the game off, and he does. He's there in part because he has started struggling in school. And his mother is very concerned for him, so concerned that she took him to the children's resource group. I told one parent of mine, he said, the teacher says I ought to take my kid to the children's resource group. And this is a young man who I had taken care of since he was a kid. You know, and I looked at him and I said, if you take him there, all they're going to do is tell you your kid's got ADHD. Why do you want to do that for? And he said, well, I think I will anyway. And so he did. And he called me back later and he said, you're right. You know, everybody who goes through this place gets labeled ADHD. It's, well, anyway, I don't want to rant. But anyway, she had taken this kid to the children's resource group, and the reason why she took him there was because he was forgetting to do his homework. You know, he's 12. Any guys in here ever remember motivated forgetting? Did you ever forget to do your homework at the age of 12? Yeah, I remember a lot of that. The boy had grown up without his father. Mom was a single mother. He had grown up in daycare and elsewhere. He was really a smart kid. He was in all gifted classes, had an IQ of 120, but he was falling behind in school. When I asked him about school, he related to me that simply that he hated it. He hates school. And I said, well, what do you like? Well, I like video games and cartoons. He has a great future ahead of him, doesn't he? Yes. One of these days he'll get a graduate degree in cartoons. That's our video games. And the mother, of course, is now remarried. That always introduces a certain amount of angst into a boy's life who's lived most of his life alone with his mother. In my hand, I had a copy of a 20-page assessment from the Children's Resource Group. In that assessment was the resume of the psychiatrist. I don't get resumes for psychiatrists when they send me notes very often. And I assumed that she must have been trying to prove to me that she knew more about this than I did or something, you know, because she was a professor at IU or something like that. And in it they said, of course, that he had ADHD and he had a mood disorder. Yes, he had a mood disorder. And the psychiatrist and the mother had talked about it and decided to put him on Abilify. Yes, Abilify, which is an atypical antipsychotic medicine. This is like no small potatoes drug, all right? Has significant side effects. It has the weight gain I told you about. It has movement disorder problems that I told you about. It has, in some kids, suicidal tendencies. That was one of the things that the kid who gained 19 pounds did for us. Before I looked at the mom and I said, you know, I think I'd take him off that drug. In spite of what the psychiatrist had said. Well, anyway, he was on Abilify because he couldn't remember to do his homework. That didn't seem to help his doing his homework a bit. And so because of that, then they put him on Focalin. Always reminds me of that. Was it The Simpsons and Focus In? Yeah, I think the drug in The Simpsons was Focus In. So anyway, Focalin. Because he wasn't focused. Now, that seemed to affect his mood more. And so on the next visit, they then put him on Prozac. Here we have a 12-year-old kid whose main transgression in life is, I don't want to do my homework. I'd rather play video games and watch cartoons. It doesn't strike me as like, you know, a disease. And for that, he's now on 3 drugs. Now, the thing that struck the stepfather, who seemed to be a fairly normal sort of guy, was that the poor kid was just sort of sitting around like a bump on a log, doing nothing. He said, I don't understand this. You know, I mean, this kid was relatively normal when I met him, and now he just sits there and stares most of the time. The effect of being on 3 different drugs. I really feel sorry for the kid. Because for about 2 years at his age, I hated school too. I really did. And I managed to do next to nothing at times and still get B's and C's. The best thing that happened to me was that they literally closed the school. They had been planning it, but they didn't tell us, you know. They opened a new junior high. And I can remember the day they came in and told us that they were closing this school that I thought was something close to a prison. I had been hiding in the library for a year reading books because of a bully. And they came in and said, you don't have to go here. Next year you're going to a brand new school someplace. And I got there and there were teachers who liked kids who could read and write. And there was a choir that I could sing in. And all of a sudden there were things that I could do that I enjoyed. And my academic future was made. I mean, you know, if I had been aimed at the 6th grade, the direction where I was going, I wouldn't be here talking to you tonight. Had something to do with a beautiful English teacher in the 7th grade who rescued my education. I always say that people need just one good English teacher, but think for a moment then about what the differences are between me and that poor 12-year-old boy today. Wow. You know, I'm really glad that my parents didn't have the money to take me to the doctor. You just didn't go to the doctor for anything when I was a kid. You needed to have part of you hanging off, you know, or bent the wrong way, or you needed to be bleeding, you know, or really sick, but just not doing your homework. You know, they wouldn't have wasted money on that. And had they, you know, the doctor would have said, well, why'd you bring him? Well, doc, he doesn't want to do his homework. And the doctor would have looked at him and said, well, you know, I'm here to take care of disease. Does he have a sore throat or something? You know, no, I'm also really glad that my And he wouldn't have thought it was abnormal for an 11-year-old boy to hate school. He would have thought that was something that he'd heard before. I'm also glad my mom stayed at home and that my parents stayed married. And then they lived in a way that they could afford to on my dad's income. You know, like, what was it? What is it, Dave Ramsey? Live your wage or something or other, or act your wage or something like that. And I was also glad that my mom wouldn't let me watch more than 30 minutes of television a day. My mom just had amazing insight. Back in 1957, when television, by today's standards, would have been considered innocuous, you know, my mom wouldn't let us watch more than 30 minutes, and she certainly wouldn't let us watch The Three Stooges. Why not? You guys remember that? Come on, you remember that, don't you? Yes, Larry Moe and Joe, Larry, or whatever they were. Yeah, we would do what we saw in The Three Stooges, and mom didn't like that, so she wouldn't let us watch it. You know what? Those are the differences between me and that boy who has an IQ of 120. What the boy faces today in school and in life is the need to fit into an educational system that absolutely bores him and that he hates. That's what his problem is. You know, I find it amazing that adults don't get it. They don't get the idea that if you send a boy or a girl down to a school that they absolutely hate, that they might come back in a bad mood. You know, if you hate your job, do you come back with a smile on your face in the evening? Do you? No. It might tend to make you grumpy. You know, if you have a job that you don't like, do you perform well at it? I can remember getting a job at JCPenney's in the summer after my senior year. God knew that I wasn't meant for retail. And I don't know how I got that job, but I hated it. I hated every minute of the time that I worked at JCPenney's. And the best thing was is that I got a job at Avis Rent-A-Car before I could get fired at JCPenney's. I quit just ahead of getting fired at JCPenney's. That's how much I hated it. And washing cars and driving around the airport at Indianapolis, I didn't have any trouble with that. I didn't have a disease. I just hated retail. You know, I would die digging ditches at the age of 80 before I'd go back and work retail again. And that doesn't mean that retail's bad. It just means that, I wasn't meant for it. Today we are faced with an exploding number of children who are graduating from the single diagnosis category of ADHD, just like that young man I'm telling you about, and who are now labeled with mood disorders, mostly bipolar disorder, and who are being treated with medications that are meant and tested mostly in adults. You know, the question that we have to answer in the next 45 minutes, 60 minutes maybe, is how in the world do we get to this place? You know, how can we go about differently helping 12-year-old boys and girls besides medicating them? Well, first we have to decide what constitutes bipolar disorder. Some of you were here last year, but I'm going to read this definition anyway. The definition of bipolar disorder is this: a condition in which the patient has periods in life which swing from major depression to mania. Mania is defined as times when the patient has increased motor activity, a pressure to keep talking, a reduced need for sleep, and a flight of ideas. These times also are marked by grandiose thinking. It's the kind of person who thinks that they're, you know, it's like the guy, a patient I knew who was trying to buy 38th Street in Indianapolis, literally trying to buy both sides of 38th Street in Indianapolis. He thought he had a lot more money than he did. Grandiose thinking, impaired or poor judgment. That was Patty Duke, Aston. Yes, she married John Aston when she was manic. Yeah, and when she woke up, she realized the mistake she had made. You know who I'm talking about? Yeah, Patty Duke. Grandiose thinking, impaired or poor judgment, impulsiveness, aggressiveness, and hostility. They may spend large amounts of money they do not have, make personally destructive decisions in business and sexual and moral matters, and it can also have thoughts of suicide and hallucinations. I'm going to put up the 2 hours that I do on bipolar disorder in general, not children's bipolar, on a website at www.nograce.org. It'll be up in the next week. If you want to hear the whole thing about adult bipolar disorder, if you weren't here last year. No Grace, K-N-O-W-G-R-A-C-E. Yeah, we figured that out later and it was too late. You know, No Grace, No Graceless, or anyway. Sometimes you just have good ideas that aren't. So, manic depression gets cut up into categories. And these include, let me think, are these in your notes? Yes, those are in your notes, so I don't have to spend a lot of time on it. And it's not really germane, very germane to the lecture on children, but I put them in there anyway. Let me tell you what the bottom line is about bipolar disorder. If you have mania, I think you have a real disease. If you don't, I don't think you do. Mania is that period in time for people who are labeled with bipolar disorder where they will stay up for 2 weeks in a row. They will spend $30,000 on a credit card. They will make disastrous decisions when it comes to moral matters. And they may and do hallucinate and become psychotic. This is something that happens in 1/10 of the population of the United States on an annualized basis. 1/10 of 1%. 1/10 of 1%. That means 1 in 1,000 or something like that. Very rare. Now, you and I know that the number of people who are being called bipolar today make up about 5 or 6 or 7% of the population because you meet them all the time. I mean, you know, it's like 1/10 of 1%. You wouldn't know, hardly know anybody who had bipolar disorder, but at 5 or 6%, which is what folks say in all these other categories, is the reason why there are so many people wandering around being told that they are bipolar in the United States today. Now that's what I think about bipolar disorder in adults. Now, what do I think about bipolar disorder in children? Well, I think it's even more different. So what is bipolar disorder in adolescents and children? Because we have an increasingly large number of kids who are being so labeled. Well, it's a really big argument in medicine today. There are some people who say that you can diagnose bipolar disorder in children at the age of 2. Between 1996 and 2004, the rate of diagnosis per 10,000 children went from 1.3 to 7.3. Instead of 1 in 10,000, there are 7 in 10,000. Now, as a practicing physician, when you see a disease, quote unquote, go up 700%, it's sort of like, well, you know, either the disease changed, we have an epidemic on our hands, or somebody doesn't know what they're talking about. You know, those are the things, those are the assumptions that you would make. It also depends on where you're geographically located. Ah, yes. If you happen to, you can unfortunately live in the wrong part of the country, because if you live near Harvard, you're in trouble. In Massachusetts, near Massachusetts General Hospital, at the age of 3, you're an uncontrollable child. There's a psychiatrist there named Joseph Biederman, who thinks that if you are impulsive, irritable, emotionally labile, or have behaviorally challenged behavior, or that you're behaviorally challenged. That's a nice way of putting it, isn't it? Yeah. We would used to say that they were, what would be an acronym for behaviorally challenged? Let me think here now. Would it be BRAT? Yes, that would be it, yes. Right, behaviorally challenged, yes, BRAT. So keep that in mind. Now, he's not saying mania. He's not talking about this two-week episode of staying awake all night and grandiose thinking and talking fast and all this kind of stuff, because how could you get that out of a 2-year-old anyway? What he's talking about is being irritable, being impulsive, being easily upset, emotionally labile, and then having uncontrollable or bad behavior. And he would say that kid has bipolar disorder and would treat them with drugs that are primarily aimed at adults. That's what he would treat them with, the same drugs that he would treat adults, except for lithium, which is always amazes me. You never see a child psychiatrist put a kid on lithium, even though they're calling them bipolar. Lithium is the drug to treat bipolar disorder with, period. It's the best drug if you really have mania, but they can't use it in kids because the kids that they are calling bipolar don't have mania. That's the important thing. There are equally qualified physicians who say that bipolar disorder does not exist in children, period. We've never seen it diagnosed in kids up until the last few years because we've all assumed that it doesn't exist in people until they're teens, late teens, 19, 20. It usually appears in college and stuff like that. Ann Duffy, in the 2007 edition of the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry, states that the valid diagnosis of bipolar disorder in impulsive, irritable, labile, or behaviorally dysregulated, that's a good way of putting it, isn't it? That's still BRAT. Children remains to be proven. Bipolar disorder is rarely diagnosable in children, period. Now, this Biederman fellow would say that there are millions of children out there needing to be found, diagnosed, and medicated. So the criteria for calling a 2 or a 3-year-old child in the United States today, if you are in Massachusetts, may not be elsewhere, but in Massachusetts, is being irritable, impulsive, angry, aggressive, and having troublesome behavior. You know, there are just a lot of kids who can fit that and who probably don't have anything other than, trouble with raising, I guess would be a good way to put it. And keep in mind that the only place this epidemic is happening is in, the United States. Yes, we're the only country on the face of the earth that has the money to have 2-year-olds who are bipolar. Every place else is figuring out how to try to stay alive and feed themselves. You know, most of it is right here. You have to have disposable income to have a bipolar child. Now, can we make this diagnosis in any certain way? And the answer is no. The Journal of Family Practice, October 2007, says there's no single well-validated screening instrument for the clinical diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children, period. So, you know, a good number of physicians say that it doesn't exist and you can't diagnose it. So then, if we don't have a good screening test, and mania is my criteria, and I think it's a good criteria, if mania were the criteria we were going to hold to, 98% of the children called bipolar would not be so labeled, period. All right? And I think that's the way it should be. I don't think these children have bipolar disorder or anything any more than the man in the moon. What do genetics contribute to bipolar disorder? The same thing they do in ADHD. We don't know. There is no identified gene for bipolar disorder in adults or children. Studies that have been done, twin studies, where you have identical twins, the labeling of individuals with bipolar disorder will vary from 40 to 97%. So that if you have identical twins and they both have a gene, they'll both have the same problem. If you have Huntington's chorea and you have the gene for it, you will die of it, period. I mean, that is the way it happens. You know, so we have not identified such a gene for bipolar disorder to this date. So we can't say what the contribution of genetics is. But I'll tell you this, you know what the main contribution of genetics is? If you're a kid and you are impulsive and irritable and aggressive and angry and behaviorally dysregulated and you have a relative who's been labeled as bipolar in any fashion, you're going to get tagged. Yeah, they're going to say because you have a relative who's bipolar, you are. And that is how the diagnosis is made, just that way. So that's the main contribution of genetics, even though it's not scientific in the least. All right, is everything that is called bipolar disorder today a disease? Well, I gave you the definition of disease in the first lecture, and the answer to that is no. Why? Because we don't have any pathology today. And I hold hard to the idea that I never call anything the Bible calls sin a disease, and I never call anything sin that the Bible, unless the Bible clearly does, so that if I don't have pathology associated with whatever this behavior is, then I am not obligated. I am not obligated to hold it as a disease-caused problem. Most of the trouble with people who actually have manic depression, most of the trouble for people who have actual manic depression, who suffer with mania, is that almost all their behavior then gets excused under the diagnosis of mania, and most of their behavior has nothing to do with it. You know, that most people who have manic depression, you know, the bipolar one, they actually have a whole list of behaviors that are problems, and none of them are connected to their disease. They're just connected with being human. And so when they're not manic, they really need to change those behaviors. And most folks who have mania struggle most because people are willing to stand around them and excuse all their behavior based on this disease instead of dealing with the non-biblical sinful behaviors that have nothing to do with mania from a biblical counseling viewpoint. I call that outgrowing the mania associated behaviors. All right. So, is there any pathology to justify calling the broad spectrum of bipolar disorder a disease? And the answer is no. We're back to scans. Scans, and of course, scanning is where it's at. Why? Well, it's because about the only way we can actually look at a human brain. You know, we can't carve your head open and take parts out and put it back together. That's just not going to work. And so a lot of what gets said about bipolar disorder in adults and children has to do with scanning. Scanning, I say, is a window. Better what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13:12. It's the glass that we look through darkly. You know, we're not actually looking at the brain. We're looking at a picture. We're not actually looking at the brain functioning. We're looking at perhaps metabolites. We're looking at blood flows and all kinds of things like that. But we're not actually looking at the brain itself and understanding it in its entirety. It does give us some amazing pictures, but it won't always give us a diagnosis. Now, you all should go on pbs.org. You should go to pbs.org. And it's been about a month ago or two, and it was the program was The Medicated Child, and it's on Frontline. And you should watch it because it gives it really, it's not exactly all even-handed, but it gives a good view of what the world thinks about medicating kids for behavioral disorders, particularly bipolar disorder. The thing that caught my attention is a part about a company in Los Angeles and Seattle and Denver that does SPECT scanning on children in shopping centers. That's single positron emission computerized tomography scans of children. They do them in shopping centers. And these are, I forget the name of the center, I can remember the lady's name. Her name was Nancy Goodhue, and she was telling her story on Dr. Phil, and they took the Dr. Phil segment and dropped it into the PBS.org thing. And you can go watch all of it, all right? And in it, she's a social worker, and she's explaining to the parents how the SPECT scan that they just did for $3,000 on this kid. Yeah, that's what I said, $3,000. It's cash, you know, because insurance companies don't pay for these kind of things. You get to write a check. You write them a check, you hand them the check, $3,000. And she said that the SPECT scan will tell us what part of the brain in the child was not working. Some parents would say that was mostly from here up, you know, or something like that. Anyway, but, it would tell the parent what part of the child's brain was not functioning properly and then what medicine to give the child from the SPECT scan. This lady is Nancy Goodhue. It's a proprietary company. They're in it to make money, which is why I don't own a CAT scanner, and I never will. You know, it's like I can't own a machine that I have to send, that I have to write a prescription for to send somebody down to get a scan that I get $1,000 back every time I send them. It's a conflict of interest, isn't it? Yes. She's shown telling the family that their boy has a mood disorder because his brain lights up differently than normal. She also tells the family how excited they ought to be because the boy's brain is changing a lot between 12 and 25. And how much better medicine is going to make in as that change occurs, how this medicine will fix the boy's brain, literally, as he grows. The problem is, of course, that while some, not very much, but while some of what she was saying might be true, the boy's brain does light up differently, and it will change over the next 10 years and finish maturing, and who knows what effect the medicine is going to have. It is not true that she can make any diagnosis with that SPECT scan, period. 2006, good review article on scans published by Kiki Chang in Development and Psychopathology, Volume 18, while neuroimaging can be used. Will neuroimaging ever be used to diagnose pediatric bipolar disorder? Currently, and this is the quote, neuroimaging cannot be used to diagnose this disorder or any other disorder other than Alzheimer's disease dementia. Alzheimer's disease dementia is the only scanning provable neurologic behavior disorder that can be diagnosed right now. There are no psychiatric disorders that can be diagnosed by neuroimaging alone to date, period. As compared to the ladies telling the folks as they're writing the check what the medicine is going to do for their child. The key to it is it alone. Well, you know, bipolar disorder is the same thing as ADHD. It's made by watching people's behavior and then assigning a diagnosis to that behavior. And I'll tell you this, you might as well skip the $3,000. I mean, you know, the outcome is going to be the same. The kid has bad behavior you don't like, you take him to the psychiatrist, skip the $3,000, just go ahead and give him the medicine, because that's what the final outcome would be anyway. And the SPECT scan doesn't add anything to it, period. All right, Problems with scans, of course, are that you get inconsistent outcomes among studies. I read a bunch of studies in order to write this, and the one study would say that part of the brain got bigger. Another study would say the same part of the brain got smaller. So part of the problem is that from age 0 to 10, metabolites in the brain rise and fall. You know, these metabolites that they're looking at will rise and then they'll start to fall again. So the brain is kind of in a constant change. And then I mentioned in the last lecture the fact that drug treatment affects all these brain scans. And it should. You know, if amphetamines actually do something to the metabolism of the brain, then you'd expect a SPECT scan or a PET scan to light up differently, and they do. So the scans really can't be used to make this kind of diagnosis. So we can't make a diagnosis of childhood bipolar disorder with a scan, and nor should we try. Then, can laboratory studies? Well, this is even better. It takes me about 2 seconds to answer this question. The answer is no. There are no lab tests which tell you whether a child has bipolar disorder or an adult has bipolar disorder or not, period. All right, now, are there medical conditions that might mimic the behavior of bipolar disorder that could appear in kids? And the answer is yes. All the behaviors seen in bipolar disorder can be seen in all these medical problems that I'm not going to discuss because I don't have time. I just put them there to tell you that if someone tries to tell you that your kid has bipolar disorder, you really ought to be having them see a good physician, not for the purpose of getting them labeled with bipolar disorder, but to make sure they really aren't just sick, all right? You need to make sure that they have a normal physical exam, a normal panel of tests and all that kind of stuff, and they don't have anything medically obvious. Okay, so what has contributed then to this rapid growth of bipolar disorder in the United States today? Well, I would say that 57% of the kids who have bipolar disorder also meet the criteria for ADHD, which probably means that they will be taking amphetamines. That's the first thing that I would tell you. The explosive growth, the smoking gun is in the hands of people who would medicate children for the problem behavior of ADHD. It's the primary driver behind the mood disorders that end up being diagnosed as bipolar disorder. What else contributes to it? Yes, if irritable depression accompanied by aggression and impulsivity are the hallmarks of bipolar disorder in children, I would tell you this, they are also the well-known side effects of amphetamine derivative drugs. So we have this large pool of kids who are taking amphetamines for ADHD, it would only be reasonable to assume that a good number of them will get identified as having bipolar disorder. One thing that pushes this is the direct-to-consumer advertisement of medication. You all are familiar with this. You don't realize it, but you are. It's that event in life where you're sitting down with your grandson to watch the football game, and all of a sudden you hear this sort of slimy guitar music come on, and suddenly there are two bathtubs looking out over the hill. Yeah, and by this time you are jumping for the control because you hope to get there before they explain this four-hour event that is dangerous if you take this medicine. You all know what I'm talking about, don't you? Yes, and you don't want to have to explain that to your grandson, do you? No, you don't. That is the direct-to-consumer advertisement of medicine. You know, sometime probably about 20 years ago, drug companies decided to skip physicians in the decision process of whether or not a person would take a medicine or not, and they bought, who was that lady, Peggy Fleming, wasn't it? The ice skater, the Vioxx ice skater. Boy, did that ever come back to bite them hard, didn't it? Yes, because everybody in the country got Vioxx who didn't need it, you know, for their joint aches and pains, and people started dropping dead from it, and then it cost them millions, if not billions of dollars before it was over with. That is the direct-to-consumer advertisement of medication, and that is part of what pushes bipolar disorder in children and in adults. We've already talked about unrestricted research grants. Well-meaning physicians contribute to the increased diagnosis. In the September 2000 in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association article by Marino and others, they estimate that 50% of the children labeled as bipolar are misdiagnosed. I'd say that's a conservative estimate, you know, the 50%. Now, the major drive, in my estimation, behind all of this widening of the diagnostic category of behavior disorders, including bipolar disorder, is the need to explain undesirable behavior in the absence of theology. and in the absence of a theology that includes the word sin. That's why. We're trying to figure out a way to explain why children don't do well or they act this way, and we don't want to talk about God, or we can't talk about God. And we can't look at them and say, well, you're just a sinner. I mean, this is pretty straightforward. We can't say things like that. And instead, we attempt, if all behavior is chemical, and this is where they're coming from, and I have no control over the chemicals inside my head, then I am not responsible for my behavior. And that collides with theology like a freight train and a semi-truck at an unmarked railroad crossing. That is what's going on today. Oh, okay. Rachel Ray, that's in your notes. You all know who Rachel Ray is? Yeah, she's a lady on the Food Channel. I'm not going to talk about Rachel Ray. I assume that the television must have been onto the Food Channel while I was writing the notes for this lecture, and somehow Rachel Ray made it into the notes. It's really Rebecca Riley, and that's who we're going to talk about. She's the next case. Rebecca Riley came to my attention last October when her story was told on 60 Minutes, CBS. Actually, I was at the NANC conference. I was getting ready to give my lectures on bipolar disorder. On Sunday evening, I sat down, turned the television on, and this is what I saw, the story of Rebecca Riley. Rebecca Riley was found dead on her parents' bedroom floor when she was assumed to be asleep. The cause of her death was an overdose of prescription drugs. She was taking, at the time of her death, for bipolar disorder, Seroquel, Depakote, and Clonidine. Seroquel is an atypical antipsychotic, Depakote, and a major drug. Depakote is an anti-epileptic drug, which is now called a mood stabilizer, but it's really just an anti-epileptic drug that makes people rather quiet and slow, and that's why they call it a mood stabilizer. And then there was Clonidine, an antihypertensive, something to lower your blood pressure, but which makes people drowsy and slow. And then Mom had given her some cold medicine on top of it, and when she was acting still agitated, Mom gave her an extra Clonidine. And then she died. This wouldn't have been too unusual if maybe she'd been 30, but she was 4. She was 4 years old at the time of her death. She had been diagnosed as a manic at the age of 2. She unfortunately lived in New England, near the Tufts New England Medical Center. There, a Dr. Keiyoko Kaifuji decided that she had bipolar mania because she was irritable and was behaviorally challenged and uncontrollable. Kaifuji was a disciple of Biederman at Harvard, who had taught her how to make this diagnosis in 2- and 3-year-olds and had taught her how to use polypharmacy. We used to say that with a sneer when I was in medical school, polypharmacy. That means you've given somebody 12 drugs at once and you don't know why you're giving them any of them. That's what we used to, and you know, it doesn't carry quite the same pejorative sense today, but it should, particularly in little children. So she was a follower of Joseph Biederman. John McClellan in Washington State says that he often sees children who are misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder and they will come to his hospital on 12 different medications. The medicine that probably killed Rebecca was Clonidine. She was dosed on a dose high enough at the time she died to kill a child her size, and the mother gave her an extra pill because she was jumpy. The mother and father right now are in jail under indictment for murder. Yes, Kaifuji has surrendered her medical license. Quite frankly, I think she should be in jail, not the parents. You can go to CBS and look at them. You know, look at the thing, and you know, and they're just simple people. And they were simple people who were doing in mostly what the doctor told them. And you know, and they were not sophisticated enough to be doing this with a child. And the doctor should have known that. You know, do no harm. That, you know, that's the first rule in medicine. Just do no harm. It's a horrible outcome. It amazes me that it doesn't happen more often because polypharmacy in children labeled bipolar, being treated with drugs being used off-label just like this to sedate them, exceeds that risk-benefit equation we were talking about. Wouldn't you say that the side effects and for Rebecca Riley far outweighed whatever benefit it was they were hoping to get? I sure would. So what are the medications that are currently used to treat this? Next slide. Right. Lithium isn't, and the reason why it isn't is because kids who get labeled bipolar never meet the criteria for mania. They're not going to ever have a manic episode, most of them, and they wouldn't have one before they're 19 anyway. The anti-epileptics, valproate, carbamazine, and Lamictal are used in these kids. Sad thing is that, you know, when you say that someone's bipolar, one of the things you're supposed to be trying to prevent is suicide. A recent article on anti-epileptics has shown that people who take anti-epileptic drugs are more likely to kill themselves than people who don't. And this was not done in a setting of bipolar disorder. This was just done looking at people who take them for seizure disorders. Also used are the antipsychotics such as Iprexa and Seroquel and Risperidone that we've talked about. SSRI antidepressants are sometimes used, but honestly, they're more trouble than they're worth. There was a recent review article on the SSRI Prozac type antidepressants, which went through 50 different studies, and it's been published in the last month, and it said that actually they don't help very much. Just people with depression, they don't help very much, which I thought was a remarkable, it was a remarkable study that looked over about 50 different other studies. All these medicines except lithium are used in the bipolar spectrum and a blizzard of other behavior disorders in children. How can we help? Well, I think, you know, one of the important things that we ought to keep in mind, aside from lithium in the treatment of bipolar disorder, there are no long-term studies that show that any of these drugs actually improve the outcome of the disease. No long-term studies, and nothing longer than 48 weeks. There was a 10-year study in Wales that looked at how bipolar disorder was being managed during this period of time when they went from just using lithium whenever you had a manic episode to where you were taking something all the time and you could be taking any or all of these drugs. And what they found was, under the new aggressive approach to treating it, including the antipsychotics and the anti-epileptics, that actually hospitalizations for bipolar disorder increased 4 times, and the likelihood of a person labeled bipolar killing themselves increased as well, instead of declining. So, you know, it would appear that treating people for... actually, more people killed themselves who were being treated than folks who were labeled bipolar who had escaped. You know, who were refusing to take their medicine and not being treated at all. You know, so that's a kind of a myth as well, that if people don't get medicated, they may kill themselves. The truth of the matter is that if they get medicated, they may kill themselves. People who take these medicines, the anti-epileptics, they are more likely to kill themselves than just try. You know, it's one thing to try to kill yourself. It's another thing to do it. Completed suicides higher among the antipsychotic medicated people and the anti-epileptic drugs versus lithium. Now, if you have actual mania and you take lithium, it does decrease your suicide rate. You know, so I have no objection to treating people who have actual manic depression. I think it's a good idea. So what can we do for these kids? Well, first off, we should, you know, limit the labeling of bipolar disorder. And let's limit it to people who actually have mania. How about that? Let's just say that the only way we're going to call anybody bipolar is if they've had a manic episode. And if they haven't, we're not going to do it. That would reduce the number of kids labeled bipolar in this country and the number of kids treated with polypharmacy by 98%. Limit the use of mood stabilizing drugs like Depakote and Lamictal and those kind of things to children with a clear diagnosis of mania. If you haven't had mania, you shouldn't be on an anti-epileptic drug unless you have seizures, all right? And maybe migraine headaches. I'll give you migraine headaches. But if you don't have migraine headaches and you don't have seizures and you've never had mania, we shouldn't put kids on these drugs. And then, avoid the use of amphetamine derivatives in children to treat ADHD. If you want to cut the number of kids with mood disorders and mood problems, then quit using amphetamines to treat a problem that could be managed by changing the educational setting. Change the environment instead of medicating the child to fit it. That's what we need to do. Then you need to work with kids to outgrow the bipolar associated behavior. That's what I was talking about earlier. You know, if a child has mania, he needs, and these are the things that I call things that are different. The child with mania, if you can find one, and I don't know that you'll find many, that child needs to be treated. But once they're not manic, they're going to have behavior problems that are not related to the mania that need to be counseled and they need to be dealt with. You know, when the kid's not manic, it's sort of like dealing with schizophrenia. When they're not schizophrenic, generally speaking, their lives look like bombed out craters. You know, people who actually have had bipolar manic depression, their lives are a wreck. and they need counseling. They need to know what the Word of God says about the way they're living and how they're responding to people. And they need to grow and change, just like everybody else does. So that's what I would call the things different. The things the same, again, as I said, all have sinned. Children and adults need to outgrow the behavior that is associated with bipolar disorder, but not caused or related to mania. And in that setting, you need to explore the issue of justification. As I said in the first lecture, not all children are saved, and as a result, they are not all going to live. They're not going to all be able to live in a godly way. That doesn't mean that you don't place standards on them, and it doesn't mean that you don't discipline them, but it does mean that we should be giving them a consistent, loving explanation of the gospel and regularly sowing that seed and pulling the weeds and waiting for God to do in a child's life only what God can and wants to do. Then, once a child comes to know Christ, you need to teach them the doctrine of progressive sanctification. It's more along the lines of teaching them the things that you'll find in that Priolo book on The Heart of Anger. It's great. Great two or three chapters on training kids. If you want to know how to train kids, you buy that book, and about the middle of it, he talks about the gymnazo principle. Gymnazo, the Greek word for athletic training. How do you actually train a child not to be a smart aleck? Some people say you can't train for attitude. That's not true. You can and you must. You know, if you don't, you're going to have a child with a bad attitude. So parents need to do that. We need to help them do it. Parents' motives must change. Instead of having a child who causes me no trouble, the poor woman, all she wanted was for her kid to do his homework, and for him to succeed in school. For wanting that, what did she get? She got a kid who sits around and stares and who is on three drugs and still doesn't do his homework. If her motive is to have a genius for a child, what the outcome is she's, I think, ruining this kid's life. If instead her motive was to glorify God and to love her child and help her child, the outcome should and could be different. My goal in raising a difficult child is to honor God and help the child, not make life easier for myself. The child also needs to understand that he or she will need to exchange the need to control, exchange the controller exchange selfishness and envy for loving God and serving others. Teaching children Christian service, teaching children sharing. I had a kid once who was struggling in life, had a VP shunt and was homeschooled and was driving the whole family crazy. And I looked at it and said, why don't you send him to school? Because then he'd be in school and they'd be at home and there'd be a little space between them. And that actually worked out pretty well. And then the parent called me and said, could you teach me how to teach my child to be popular? And I gasped. I think audibly I gasped. The kid would go to school and he wanted friends desperately, and he would drive kids away by driving them crazy by his eccentric behavior. And I said, well, if you try to teach your kid to be popular, you're going to create a monster. I got a better idea. Why don't you teach your child how to be a friend? Why don't you teach your child how to go find the other kid in class that nobody wants to sit with and serve that child? If you can teach your child how to be a servant, he'll always have friends. If you want him to be popular, he'll just be a jerk. That's the difference. And that we need to teach children. Teach children how to serve others. Children need to learn to outgrow anger. I think you guys get a lecture about that, so I'm not going to stop there. If irritability and aggressive behavior are childhood equivalents in mania, when you look at Galatians 5:19, you go look at Galatians 5:19, you know what the deeds of the flesh are? Immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, which is kind of being argumentative, strife, which is getting in fights, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, and factions, drunkenness, and carousing. All the behavior of bipolar disorder is listed in the deeds of the flesh, every last bit of it. And so if you look at a kid and you you're struggling with their behavior and they're young. The one thing you have to keep in mind is that this is it's a deed of the flesh. Now, what are the fruits of the Spirit? They are love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, meekness, faith, and self-control, right? Can you teach the fruits of the Holy Spirit? Think about this now. It's a trick question. Can you teach them? Or are they something that the Holy Spirit has to be in somebody's heart in order to bear? You follow what I'm trying to say? Yeah, sometimes it is hard to deal with children who haven't made it in yet. So you discipline them in hope. You share the gospel with them. But as a parent, you keep firmly fixed in mind that this unsaved kid, he's going to have to get saved before he gets it. I didn't get it until I was 19. I don't know about you, but I didn't get it until I was 19. I'm certain that I caused my parents great grief in that period, before I was 19. In fact, I know I did. So you have to have the parent keep in mind in dealing with the child who's struggling with school or whatever, or with the impulsive, aggressive, irritable behavior that, well, we're going to discipline them and train them, but we're also going to wait for the day when the Holy Spirit comes to live inside their heart and they bear the fruit, or the Holy Spirit bears fruit in their life. All right, now, so, okay, next page. Boom. All right. The child needs to abandon the need for self-esteem and instead substitute humility and Christian service. We spend waste so much time talking about self-esteem in children. I had one lady stop me and tell me that, kids who have ADHD, their self-esteem is so much better when they're on medication. And I didn't tell her this, but what I really wanted to say was, so what? I mean, when is loving yourself considered to be a Christian virtue? No place that I know of. The only place that's considered to be a virtue is in the educational system today. The only place where it's important is in the educational system today. What's important for Christian children? They are supposed to love whom? The Lord, their God, with all their heart and all their soul and all their mind. And then who are they supposed to love? Their neighbor. Yeah. Not themselves. So abandoning self-esteem as a goal and instead substituting for it humility and Christian service. You will get to deal with specific sins in children. Rebellion, sexual immorality, and dishonesty. All those kids will do all of those things. And it shouldn't surprise us that they do. And we should respond to them and respond to that in a biblical way. We should work to grow godly character in these children. As I said, help them outgrow worry and fear by being dependable, being a dependable parent, as I said in the first lecture. Children who have mood problems and who are going to get labeled bipolar need good habits. They need regular hours. Children need to sleep anywhere from 8 to 12 hours a night regularly. I was talking to a gentleman at the break, and he said he did a survey among his sixth graders, and he found they were watching 36 hours of television a week. This was years ago, and they're probably watching more now. And I added to that, and yes, and they're watching Jay Leno. They'll tell you the jokes on Jay Leno. That should, that's scandalous when you think about it. Which also means that they're staying up until 11:30 and 12 at night, and getting up at 6 in order to go to school, which means they're not getting enough sleep. Kids need more sleep. They need to eat better. Yeah, the gentleman who asked about diet, children need to eat a better diet than they do on the whole. Perhaps less emphasis on rapidly metabolizable carbohydrates and more emphasis on good fruits, vegetables, and meat and things like that. They also need more exercise. If you look at the reason why children are getting fat in the United States today, it isn't because they're eating more junk food. People think that's true. It is not. The difference between the reason why kids are getting fat today is they don't go outside and play. They sit in front of a television or they play a computer game. And it's the decline in physical activity that is required to burn up the junk that all of us used to eat when we were kids anyway. We used to eat cupcakes and ho-hos and Twinkies, but we went outside and played because we couldn't conceive of staying inside. So they need more exercise. Children need to learn good communication, as do parents. Mostly what I'm telling you is that children who might get labeled with mood disorders, they just need a normal raising. You know, that would be a good way to put it. You get down to church attendance. You know what really disturbs me about a lot of people who are believers today is that somehow they've got church down to about 60 minutes on Saturday night, you know, because I don't want to get up on Sunday morning and I can sleep in if I go on Saturday night. You know, I'm not going to get any argument about the appropriateness of Saturday night services versus Sunday morning. But, you know, the goal in being in church and having your child in church is not to see how little time you can spend there, which is the tendency. And also then to blame the church for taking up too much of your time. You know, most kids today are in two sports at once, and they're watching 6 hours of television, or they're playing computer games 6 hours, and their parents are going, both parents are working, and, you know, so they can keep the house with the three-car garage and the two cars or whatever. And it's like, it's not the church that's taking up your time. And we as a society have become so materialistic that it's almost impossible for us to raise children in a normal fashion. It's like we need to turn away from that and turn back to a godly way of raising kids that we did in the past. All right. Kids need good work habits. That means kids need chores. They actually need to go do things. They need to take out the trash. They need to cut the grass. They need to sweep the floor. I used to discipline my kids by making them clean toilets. Yeah, we had the cleanest toilets in the community at times. You know, if they did, yeah, I just send them to clean the toilets. They need these kind of chores. They also need the kind of discipline that makes them do things because it helps them work it off. You know, there's a merit to doing restitutionary things. And then children need to be taught financial responsibility by parents. I had a couple of kids come in for counseling with their mother, and they were arguing that the mom wanted them to go get jobs and help pay for something, which I thought they should, but they said that they wanted to see the budget. And I thought about that for a while, and of course the mother thought that was a little forward of them, and my response was, show them the budget. You know, one, they need to see the budget. You know, the reason why most of our kids cannot manage their finances today is because nobody's ever taught them to. They weren't taught that in home. And so I told them to manage the budget. Now, we're at the end of the lecture. Let's answer questions. It's 8:45. Questions about children's bipolar disorder. I guess the skinny line is that I don't think it exists. Yes. In my counseling, I don't tell anybody to stop anything. What I do is, frankly, most of the time, and you get this in I teach a lecture about this. I ignore medicine for the most part, unless that medicine is making it impractical for the counselee to do counseling. I've had counselees come in, and they're so sedated by the medicine they're taking that I can't talk to them. I will send them back to their doctor, and I tell them to tell their doctor that they can't stay awake, and would you adjust their medicine? And the doctor will. You know, if a patient can't stay awake, the doctor will adjust the medicine. Then my next tact is when I think that children should be off medication, usually we wait till about the school year is over, and I send them to the doctor, and I tell the parents, you go to the doctor, you tell them that it's summer, you want to see how the child can do on their own without medication, and I'd like for you to help me wean them off during the summer. And most doctors will do that. If the doctor refuses, then it really is time for a second opinion. And I would say, you know, I'm in a little bit different position than you all are, because I am a doctor. But I still don't tell people that aren't my patients to stop taking medicine. I will send them back to their doctor with instructions to ask the doctor to modify the dose and to take, you know, and give them the story like, I'm doing well, I'm in counseling, and I want to see if Junior really needs this. I tell you, though, I really have strong feelings about what treating 3 and 4 year old kids with these kind of medicines. And, you know, in counseling, if they appeared, I would be encouraging the parents to get another opinion from another doctor. You know, I would be arranging it as a physician. That's not your position, but I would be encouraging parents to get another opinion, and I would probably try to help find a child psychiatrist who did not believe that children have bipolar disorder, since I don't think it exists. Yes. So I'm not encouraging you to tell anybody to stop taking medicine. That's something that the doctor ought to do, and you should send them back to their doctor to do it. Answer the question?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Well, determine the diagnosis, and then if you do, okay, say that there is a way to determine that diagnosis, what if you have a individual that's over the age of 21 and medical and the laws will not allow the parent to submit the child to the screenings, that person has to willfully go on their own. What is the true diagnosis then if this childhood diagnosis is incorrect?
What do I think we're seeing in children who are 2 and 3 years old and who are... Well, the dividing line is mania. Mania is a very specific event, and it's really not hard to look at and see. Schizophrenia is the same way. You know, when people are talking to you and telling you that you're Jesus Christ or John the Baptist, and they really believe it, and they can't be dissuaded, then, you know, that's really different than just somebody who's irritable and hard to live with and who can't focus and who can't concentrate. Mania is similar in that sense, in that you have a person who has a constellation of symptoms that are pretty spectacular and very, very, very repeatable. If you're going to have mania, you're going to be up, you know, for 2 weeks. You're going to be talking really fast. You're going to have grandeur in your thinking. Grandiose thinking. You're going to be spending money you don't have, making very impulsive, bad judgment decisions. This isn't something that's all that hard to identify, and it doesn't happen very often. And that's still, there is no pathology to make that diagnosis from. I mean, there's no test, there's no scan at this point that we can look at and actually press a button and come out with a diagnosis. Now, when you see that, generally speaking, in adults, the reason why you can get it treated is because they become incapacitated. You know, at some point in time, a person who has manic depression will become incapacitated. And then the law allows you to intervene. The law will intervene.
What's the incapacitation definition? What do you mean?
It's like one lady. Well, like one lady standing on the rail of a bridge, you know, talking out of her head about things that didn't exist, and threatening to jump off the bridge. She was manic, had committed adultery, you know, several things, you know, just several major things, and made absolutely no sense when you talked to her. You know, just you could talk to her, but she wasn't connecting, and that kind of behavior gets you 72 hours someplace and generally labeled and treated.
So if there's no pathology to trail that, how are we determining that is what that is? How are we determining these manifestations?
Same way we do migraine headaches.
Sorry.
The same way we do migraine headaches. Migraine headaches don't have any identifiable pathology either. Anybody that ever has had a family member that has them doesn't think that they don't exist. And you know, it's like my mother-in-law had them, my wife has had them. We have two daughters, one that looks more like me and one that looks exactly like her. The one that looks like me doesn't have them, the one that looks exactly like my wife does. There's no pathology that I can show you in order to make a diagnosis of migraine headaches, but they'll end up being called that and treated. And actually treated pretty well with Imitrex and medications like that. The same thing is true with lithium and mania. So the key to it is mania. Outside of mania, all the rest of it becomes less clear.
So say there's a period of mania.
Mm-hmm. Oh, generally speaking, once they get done with that, they'll get profoundly depressed. And this can go on for weeks, and they can cycle back and forth between the two. Now, I can tell you this, though. Sometimes the cycle will be 2 years. They'll go 2 years between manic episodes, maybe three. The average person who has untreated manic depression, bipolar 1, they'll have 4 episodes of mania in 10 years if you don't treat them at all. That's what the natural course of the disease is. And I call it a disease in violation of my own standard. See, the trouble is you don't know everything. I don't. Nobody does. And sometimes we look through the glass darkly and we have to make our best judgment. And I make the judgment about bipolar disorder based on seeing mania. You know, if I see that, then I get real comfortable about what I'm doing. Once we depart mania, then I'm not comfortable with all of it at all.
Would you say it's fair to say that, in your opinion, lithium does much more good than it does harm in that case?
Yes, I would say it does do much more good than it does harm. It actually lowers suicide rates. Some hints in the scans, which I know I've savaged, that say that the changes that we think might exist for people with bipolar mania, that maybe those changes regress when people take lithium. So, but that still, that's somewhat speculative. I hope I answered your question.
Lithium to be administered during the mania period?
Yes.
Not during the depression period.
Well, actually, the lithium works for the depression side of it too. So it would cover both. Covers both better than any other medication currently available. Okay, over here. We don't get much lithium, but actually I think that was the way this was all figured out. It was figured out in areas of the country where there's a high concentration of lithium in the groundwater. Yeah, I think that was how this was stumbled upon. Question back there.
Why are you able to diagnose Alzheimer's with a scan and not
by? Because there are very specific repeatable changes in the brain that occur in everybody who has Alzheimer's. You know, you can put it up there and boom, they've got shrinking brain, all of them do. And then there's actual pathology. When you do the post, it's You know, I learn this every 10 years when I take my boards, but, you know, there's changes in the cells that are very reproducible every time. Okay, next, yes.
Yeah, I really like your list here for overcoming bipolar disorder.
Uh-huh.
It really looks like it applies to adults for a lot of them.
Oh, it does. That's the whole point. How did I come up with that? You know, I probably absorbed it as I was studying what people like Doc Smith and Jay Adams told me. None of this would actually be original to me. Well, but in looking at people who have bipolar disorder, these are the things that I see. When I talk about the list of behaviors, those are the behaviors that I see in people who show up in